American Academy of Pediatrics came out with new recommendations about how to decrease injuries in football, and they made reference to having qualified athletic trainers available. The second one was an article about Gary Vitti, and I had the pleasure of meeting Gary, but it really fell into prevention of injuries. And then two were out of CNN about the recent deaths that are happening in high school football, and they really make reference to, can we prevent these from happening, which then led us into a conversation about can we have other measures, diagnostic testing that would help. And so I think Bubba and I are on two different sides of an issue. One of the questions that was posed, and it was actually posed by my mom, which was, well, we should have, EKGs for all these kids. And so as we all agree, well, if we're going to order these tests or if we're going to advocate for these tests, there are bigger issues at hand. Yeah, medically they may be warranted or prudent, but then there's a financial issue and a sociological issue and a psychological issue and, an emotional issue and all these other things. And then Bubba started to go into, well, if you look at, and I think what you said was, when a kid comes back and it's a positive EKG of a heart condition, can this, are there enough cardiologists or pediatric cardiologists to go around? And I think you also identified that there were 9 conditions.
Yes.
That were identified, and of the 9, only 2 can be detected on EKG. So, Bubba, if you can catch everybody up about what you were talking about.
Just talking about, I'm right now, as it sits, I'm against mass mandatory ECG testing. Mm-hmm. I don't, from what I've read, the evidence is not out there that it's going to do what some proponents say it will do. Okay, throw me against the wall, whatever you want to do, that's my opinion. My point being is, in Texas, we all athletes and parents for public schools fill out a form that gives them awareness about sudden cardiac death, or sudden cardiac arrest. I think that's a good thing. But when you look at the form, there's 9 conditions that they throw out there. Only 2 of them can be picked up by ECG. So I think the way it's written, it's flawed. The parents are thinking, well, these are all the things that they can pick up because they hear ECG testing, but it's not what they can pick up. Mm-hmm. The other thing on there is also commotio cordis is listed as an acquired condition. It's not acquired, it's traumatic. Mm-hmm. So I've spoken with some of our doctors, and in the form, we think the form needs to be rewritten.
Right, so it's not that these tests are bad, right? These are quantifiable tests that can produce outcomes that would guide your treatment protocol. So let me go back and I read an article that, was talking about sudden cardiac death, and I think, it's a low level percentage, but, let's say 18% of the population, just the average population, will die before the age of 25 because of sudden cardiac. I mean, that number, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's a low number, that will die of sudden cardiac death or sudden cardiac arrest. Anyhow, right?
Right.
And so it's assumed that part of that population is going to be of the athletic population. Mm-hmm. And the question is that, well, can we put measures in place that would help detect or prevent them? So for instance, how do you know that there's a structural defect of the heart? You're not going to pick it up from an EKG. You've got to go do, and you got to go, go get an echo.
Right. Echo or an MRI.
Right. And so these are expensive measures,
right?
And not everybody can afford them.
Right.
So now you're getting into the argument of, well, only a certain population could afford them and another couldn't.
Right.
Right.
So now you've got class warfare.
Right.
Well, if you look at, I think, and the reason I said that about the form is because most people think ECG, it'll pick it up. And we know that's not the case. It only picks up certain conditions. And then a lot of people will, and I've got a bunch of different things running through my head I want to bring up here if I can do it before we start. And a lot of people talk about, well, the Italian study. Well, the Italian study's flawed in that it took a certain condition for the Italians that they suffer from that can be picked up on ECG and drop their mortality rates down to what the American average was. Mm-hmm. So people assume, well, we can just do that and drop our rates. Well, we're not looking for the same problem. And I'm a proponent of a better medical history. Right now, Texas is one of the few states that gets all 12 points of the American Heart Association on there. It's now 14 points. Minnesota uses 14, and they've dropped their numbers dramatically just off medical history alone and not mandating an ECG test. And if you look at the numbers, roughly there's 1 million public school athletes, grades 7 through 12 in Texas. That's a lot of ECG testing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of echoes. Where's somebody going to go in far west Texas to go see a pediatric cardiologist?
Mm-hmm. And that brings up another issue of that. Okay, well, and ECG or an EKG is run, and you identify there's an issue, and now that primary care physician refers out to the cardiologist, pediatric cardiologist, And quite frankly, there just aren't enough of those trained.
Right.
And so now what you're dealing with is, you know, a sociological phenomenon of, you know, this kid now can't play,
right,
you know, 6 to 8 weeks. And this leads into other issues, mm-hmm, sure, you know, especially of the teenage. So, you know, one of the things that I want to throw out for our listeners, and obviously everybody would totally understand if I brought up concussion, right? So part of the concussion is that you go to the emergency room and you
CAT scan.
Yeah, you do a CT scan, and the CT scan comes back clean. Mm-hmm. And so the assumption is what?
They're fine.
Yeah, there is no concussion, right? But everything we know about the concussion now says that, well, a CT scan is, because I think it's one out of every 100,000 traumatic brain injuries is a bleed. And so that's what you're trying to pick up.
Right.
And so the likelihood of you having a bleed in there is between small and none, and that we know we have to do all this other cognitive testing. The majority of society doesn't understand that.
Right.
And so I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask some of our listeners, you know, we've identified, here are some areas that, okay, you know, what types of testing, and I'm going to use all these different analogies. I want to, you know, decrease back pain, or I want to increase hip mobility. And so I'm going to use the FMS. Is that the gold standard? No, it's a tool that we can use to help us identify some areas where we want to be able to produce some better outcomes and increase, you know, better patient outcomes. And so the question I would ask you, Bubba, is we've identified that there's a problem, and now we need to have some people come to the table and come up with some solutions. And so, you know, is the solution EKG or an ECG? I don't think that is the solution. I think it's part of it. Can we afford to have echoes for everybody? Well, you know, no, unfortunately.
When the research shows you do 250,000 echoes to get one true issue with that. So.
And so, you know, it's one of those conversations of what's the solution to the problem, if there is even a solution, or, you know, with the emergence of social media, right, we're aware of everything that's happening outside of our own little bubble. And, you know, we're talking about these. So in your opinion, Bubba, what's the solution to the problem?
The first step to me is making the medical history have teeth. And by that, I mean, and I've said this to you before, if I'm your parent and I falsify your medical history, mm-hmm, and we find that it was falsified, something should happen to both you as the athlete and me as the parent. Mm-hmm. Because if the medical history is flawed, we all know the physical examination is flawed. Mm-hmm. So I've endangered you, mm-hmm, by lying on your medical history.
And I mean, you talk about parental endangerment. I mean, yes, you're
child endangerment, right there.
Yeah, right. And so you think that should be punished at the same level as, you know, is it, you know, neglect? Is it?
Well, I
mean, those are words and laws that are punishable. You know, you're going to be in jail.
You can make the emotional argument of yes. I think you've got to sit back and look at that, but. Okay, it's different if I'm lying that you've never sprained your ankle because I basically, you know, big deal, it was an ankle sprain, mm-hmm, on there, mm-hmm, versus I'm lying because you're asthmatic, diabetic, mm-hmm, and you've got high blood pressure. Those, mm-hmm, are different issues altogether. And so, you know, I mean, if I don't remember that, you know, as a second grader, you got a concussion, I'm probably not going to remember that. I'm fine with that, but you're asthmatic and we don't put it on there because I don't want you to get failed on your physical, mm-hmm, and all of a sudden something happens. That's a problem. And
so, I mean, what's the consequence? You know, the child is disqualified.
I don't think they're disqualified. I think they're immediately disqualified pending an investigation as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm. All right, 30-second wrap-up. Finish your conversation.
We can't finish it in 30 seconds.
All right, so then we'll go ahead and kick it off here and get started. You guys ready? Here we go in 3, 2. See, I'm doing this countdown because I'll probably go back and edit that part out for the podcast later and put it at the end. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'll just cut it out and just go with it.
Just put it on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. 3, 2, 1. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, number 190, Catastrophic Injury and Death Revisited. The goal for today is to create an after-action plan so that you can take this to your district, so that you can be prepared, so that your district can be prepared, so that your school can be prepared if something happens. So I am your host, Jeremy Jackson. Sitting right beside me, you've got
Jeranisha,
Joshua,
Jasmine,
Cooper,
Tiana.
All right, and then we are joined by Bubba Wilson and Dr. Josh Yellen from the University of Houston. They were the ones chatting it up earlier, and so hopefully you'll catch all that. If you want to join our conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, #TheSMB on Twitter. So we got Nelly and Juanita over there on Twitter, people taking notes. Real quick, I screwed up. I set the schedule for this broadcast to go live at 9 for some reason. I don't know, just busy.
You were tired.
Yeah, and so and I looked at the thing, and there was like 13 people registered, and 7 people had logged in to watch live, and then I'm just like, oh, crud. So we have 3 people logged in live. Who's logged in there, Jasmine?
Doc Hale, Christy K, Alexandria Beelands.
All right, so thanks for logging in and showing me grace for the screw up. So I know that there may be some people checking their email a little bit and logging in just a little bit, but again, that was all my fault. So without much further ado, again, we're going to provide actionable steps. But before we get to the actionable steps, I kind of want to run through what happened and then kind of my experience, and then we'll go through and see, and this is what I would like to happen and things like that. So Melissa's going to play a video. Jasmine, there you go.
I'm going to get right to it. Recently, we have experienced a loss, and today we'll be just discussing the grief process. And so I'm going to start off with the timeline of kind of what I know happened, and then we'll go from there. All right, so we have a kid that goes down on the track. The coach calls the athletic training room and checks on the athlete. So he says, you know, he's breathing, but he's out. So then coach decides something's not right. Before the athletic trainer gets there, coach begins to call 911. The other athletic trainer, Bill, arrives, and then he calls me because I'm in the weight room with my students and says, bring the AED. So I send a student to sprint out there with the AED, and then I'm getting there as fast as I can. When I get there, I hook up the AED. We let the AED do its job. It says shock, and so we do that. Then we continue compressions and breath until EMS takes over. So then me and Bill go back to the training room. We kind of talk about what happened and then go from there. I change clothes, go eat lunch, and head to the hospital. This whole time thinking, all right, well, I'm going to go in there and, you know, see he's doing all right. You know, maybe he's still unconscious or something like that, but I'm going to go to the hospital and just check on him and the family, and they're going to be like, hey, thanks for saving my son. Well, before I get to the hospital, as I'm like in the parking lot there at the hospital, I get a text saying that he had passed. So even at that point, like, it's still like, oh, okay. Because you know, I'm not really expecting it. It's not real at that point. So then I go in and, you know, a couple of the coaches are already there. They're the ones that had specifically worked with him that year. You know, they're there crying and praying and stuff like that. And some of the family members are there, but most of the family members are actually in the back in the room where he is. So, you know, I'm seeing these grown men cry, so my heart begins to break. But so I'm there for a while, or for a couple hours, just sitting, kind of talking to family members, talking to our principal and our assistant principal that are there. So the hardest part, the part where my story is probably different, because just doing CPR and walking away, EMS does that stuff all the time. But seeing the family, the mom come out of the room, knowing that her son is gone, you know, one of the assistant principals asked me or introduced me to the mom, said, hey, this is Jeremy. He's one of our athletic trainers, was taking care of your son. And so then she said, she asked me what happened, and, you know, obviously she's crying. So like, I'm choked up. I start to tell her kind of what happened. I couldn't even finish telling her what happened. And she just says, thank you. So there was never a, why didn't you save my son or anything like that? She just said, thank you. So, you know, the nurse is talking to me saying, hey, you know, we don't have any idea what happened. We're going to do all this other stuff later, but, you know, we've done everything we could and nothing worked. So then, you know, she goes over and talks to the mom while I'm standing right there. And she asked her, where do you plan to bury your son? So like, even now, that's the most difficult thing to say or to hear. I have children, I have kids, and to think about having to plan that or do that, it's very, very difficult. It's tough. So I've said this pretty much to everybody I've talked to. It's never for Bill, it's never a feeling of guilt, like we didn't do something we were supposed to do. We did everything we could. Well, we did it as fast as we possibly could, but it's my heart is broken for that family. The fact that they won't get to say, you know, goodbye or have a good day, or, you know, you're in trouble or something like that. Then, hang on just one second.
All right. So at that point, that was the video that we did. That was about maybe a week and a half right after, the student athlete passed away. And so I just took that clip out so that I could go through the timeline, and you can hear the emotion in my voice. And watching it yesterday, I was telling the kids, and like I still teared up just listening to my story yesterday. It's just not easy thinking about those things. And so here's just a brief timeline of kind of what happens. Is I'm sitting there at the hospital, and I receive a phone call saying, "Hey, I'm sorry for your loss, but I basically just need you to write up everything that happened and submit that to me." And then from there we go on, and we had state testing the next week. So on Monday I was in the testing room giving the state test. I just happened to be down here in the gym for lunch, and I saw that the kids were going in there. I said, "All right, well, hey, y'all need to go in there and do this." And I just walked in there to kind of just to be there and see what they were doing. And then I broke down. I started crying, and it was really, really tough. And so I just happened to be there when there was somebody doing counseling. And so obviously that's not very good. So then I spoke with the counselor there for, you know, an hour or whatever. And like I said, I was crying the whole time, just heartbroken. So then one of them checked back in on me once or twice over the next few days. And then Bill and I, after we had talked to some people, we decided to kind of switch off days. So like, I think I took off a full day and he took off the next day, and we just kind of switched off like that back and forth. But again, it was basically us just saying, "Hey, this is what we're going to do," and then doing it. Our basketball coaches were the ones that were there with the athlete. He was a basketball athlete. And so they came by and checked on us a couple different times. And then one of the assistant principals, she was out there as well. She kind of checked on us a couple times. But that was, from as far as I can tell, you know, unless I'm just missing something, that was the end of the support, the counseling, and that kind of thing, as far as dealing with that. You know, we went to the funeral, and that gave us some closure and that kind of stuff, but that was really more or less the end of it, unless somebody else checked on me. And so the athletic training community, you know, Josh, you called me that day or the next day, something like that, and talked to me and said, "Hey, you know, anything you need?" I know Bubba came by and talked to us, and there were several different emails, texts, phone calls that I got as far as dealing with that from the athletic training community. But we're going to discuss some of that here in a little bit. So what I feel went well during it was they reminded us, "Hey, don't talk to the media, you know, or send them to this person. This person is the only person that should be talking to the media." So they did that good, right? So because we don't want to make any big mistakes and say something that we shouldn't say. There was an effort made to counsel the students. They made, obviously they had the big counseling session, but then they made counselors available and they allowed kids to go over there and talk. And, you know, these students losing their classmate in front of them is pretty tough, and they need to deal with it. And like I said, there was a lot of support from the athletic training community. So that's about what I feel went well. Again, hopefully I'm never in this situation again. I don't have anything to compare it to. But then just some of the things that I feel need improving were, there should have been, and Bub and I have talked about this, there should have been an in-person conversation, someone coming over saying, "Hey, tell me what happened," or, "Here, let me record it and then I'll write it down." Instead of just a phone call saying, "Hey, type this up and send it to me." And it's just, you know, it does show a little bit of a lack of concern or lack of emotion just by giving a phone call saying, "Hey, type this up and send it to me."
Hey, Jeremy, can I interject real quick?
Yeah.
I've thought about this earlier as we've been thinking about this a lot, talking about it. We all, and the purpose of this podcast is to talk about this after aspect, but we all do the emergency action plan. If X occurs, we do Y. What are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? And I don't think through any fault of anybody, we don't think about the what if the worst occurs after the fact. And so the point of this is there's no blame being put on anybody, no fault or blame being put on anybody. But I don't think we look at, well, what should we do if our outcome is bad at the end? And so that's the point of this. You know, we can't say this was done wrong. There was no, there was nothing in place to say, you know, we need to do this if this occurs. And so this is the point of this. Again, what was done was not wrong or malicious or heartless. I don't think we plan for the C-spine injury, but we don't plan if, what if that kid is now a paraplegic? What do we do now? What's the next steps? And so that is the point of this talk today.
You know, the other thing I would add to what Bubba is saying is that, you know, we have the emergency action plan in place. Why? Because from a legal aspect, we need to do it. From, you know, an outcomes-based aspect, we need to do it. But I think there are some things that are missing from those emergency action plans. And I think you just alluded to it, which was, okay, what happens if the worst occurs? And how do we treat the people that are treating the people, right? And so how do we help our athletic trainers and physicians and students and coaches and all those other mm-hmm. people that are involved? What types of measures do we have in place that are going to help them psychologically, emotionally, spiritually? Because they were there, right? And they saw it and they were involved. And so what's going to help them proceed through this process, right? Obviously, you know, the family is grieving of any particular case. The family is grieving. Friends are grieving. The community is grieving. But fact of the matter is, and I don't want to be callous about this, there's still a job that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And so from a psychological, emotional, even spiritual standpoint, what's in place that we can help these, you know, people through? And you brought up a really interesting point, Jeremy, which was, you know, you have paramedics and firefighters, right? They do this every day, all day. And I've got a great friend that's a paramedic firefighter in Los Angeles. And we touch base, you know, once every couple of weeks, and he tells me about, like, the grossest things ever. And the difference is that in the environment that you're in, you knew this person, right? Paramedic, firefighter, the likelihood of them knowing somebody is between small and none.
Right.
So there's this emotional disconnect, right? I'm just doing a job. In the athletic training world, in the sports medicine world, right, we develop this relationship with our patients. And so it's a really unique environment. And so when something does happen, you do take it personally. And so that's where we're kind of at right now is that, okay, yeah, I am taking this personally, and how do I deal with this? And what is the after action plan, right? Because we have the emergency action plan, and we rehearse this, and we rehearse it as if, okay, everything went well. But what happens when it doesn't go well?
But even if it went well, it may not go well in the end.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, sure. Again, everything was done appropriately. The outcome was bad. And so that we're, and we've got some points to on that. But yeah, what, I mean, we can do everything, you know, you do everything by the book, it was flawless, but
yeah, I mean, you can't control the outcome. So,
right.
You know, when I was a student, one of my team physicians, Eric Sletton, he was the team physician at Cal State Northridge, he's an ER doc, sports medicine fellowship trained. And we used to do some rotations with him in the ER. And so when I was at the ER with him, and I saw some really bad things. And I was having, obviously, as an undergraduate student, I was having some trouble processing that. And he saw that. And so he took some time and he pulled me aside and he said, look, you know, in science and medicine, you are trained to do what you're trained to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as much as you try to control the outcome, you can't. So you work these processes that are in place, that there's some evidence behind that these work, and you go through that process, but you can't control the outcome. So he put it the best way that I've heard, right, which was, I do everything I can do to control the outcome, and then the rest is not up to me. And right. So, you know, I took that, and everybody will interpret that any way they want to interpret it. I interpreted it as I can do the very best I can do and how I was trained, and the rest, right, we all have to understand, you know, it's just not up to me.
Right.
Right.
You can only do your part.
Yeah.
All right. So some of the things that I would like to see, and again, this is going to be included in the recommendations for your plan. And again, if you're in the live chat or if you're listening to this just a little bit later, I'm actually going to send out our recommendations via email, and I'm asking for your feedback to help us build a more solid or a more thorough after action plan so that it's going to be the best product we can produce for you to submit. So some of the things that I would really like to see is regular intervals. I mean, it can be easily automated. Schedule an email to say, hey, I was just checking on you. Even if, you know, I'm not really thinking about you at this moment, well, I scheduled that email, you know, for the next 4 weeks to just say, hey, I'm thinking about you. And then you can easily respond and say, thanks. Or you can easily respond and say, you know, I'm really struggling, or I feel down, or I feel great, or whatever. But easily just set something up to schedule those emails. And then, like I said before, there was a little perceived effort to continue providing care or checking on those people who provided the life-saving measures, like you're saying, taking care of the people who did that. And there definitely is an emotional connection. It's not like EMS where they do that day in, day out, you know, 20, 30 times a day, and they don't know the people. They don't check on them afterwards. They don't go to the funerals. And so that's definitely something I hope that you do not experience in the loss of an athlete, but also the just the feeling somewhat unsupported by
left out.
Yeah, left out. Just like, okay, well, we'll take care of the kids and everybody else will be all right. So
I know, Jeremy and I talked about this a bunch, and this is one of my two big points of today is you bring in the grief counselors for the kids, and that's understandable. But again, the people directly involved had no true grief counseling. And I think one of the things that needs to happen in an after-action plan is the best analogy I can give is think of an officer-involved shooting. They have to go to counseling. Mm-hmm. I think it needs to be stated that, okay, those involved need to go to a counseling session, minimum one, that says, are they able to perform their job? Because if this happens again, are they going to be able to do their job effectively? And so I don't think you say, how you doing? I'm good. Okay, we're done with you. I think it needs to be, you need to go to someone professionally that's that cost is, you know, borne by the district or whomever your employer is, and say they're okay to come back to work. Now, whether or not you want to take days off or you want to come right back to work, everybody grieves and everybody handles it differently. That's up to you. But I think that you should be required to make an appointment within a certain amount of time and go be evaluated.
And I would add to this, and I would say that whatever counselors are identified, they have to be identified, I suppose, by the district, and they have to have certain qualifications, right? Because not every counselor is good at grief, and that the support group needs to understand this kind of Kubler-Ross, you know, these five stages. And as somebody is grieving, to be able to identify what stage are they in.
Right.
You know, because for instance, let's say somebody is able to get through the, you know, I'm depressed, or I mean, I'm angry, or, you know, denial and anger, but then I'm stuck in that depression. This leads back to, you know, can I perform my job?
Right.
And if this happens again, and unfortunately the likelihood of this happening again, you know,
exists,
and, you know, is this person going to experience a post-traumatic stress event?
Right.
You know, and are they going to freeze? And are they, you know, all these other emotions come back. And unfortunately, you know, one of the things that we identify in, you know, our curriculum is obviously there's a psychosocial aspect to what we do, but are we applying that to us?
Right.
Who's watching out for us?
Right.
And I would agree with that analogy of if there's a police officer involved shooting, there has to be some sort of debriefing.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's my other big one that we're going to, yeah, that's on there for me. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'll see what he comes up with next.
Okay.
All right. So let me read through this list and then we can go break it down and give input. All right. So our recommendations, what Bub and I discussed over some barbecue was the district administrative personnel should be on the scene immediately to debrief the professionals involved to get the statements, offer counseling, or just an ear. All right. So she should be there in person to deal with all that stuff. Not a phone call or email or text or anything, just show up and take care of it. So the district should require each person involved in to attend mandatory counseling sessions by a licensed counselor, at least one session. That's as Bubba was just saying. So the district should require the involved individuals to take at least 3 out of the next 6 days off of work. Obviously not affecting the pays or the day off, something like that. And that one there, it kind of depends on the situation. But taking some time off.
Being allowed to take that time.
Yeah, being allowed to take that time off. That's what we said. I think I forgot to change it. So, and then the district sets the gradually increasing intervals to meet, to contact the individual parties to check in. So, like I said, scheduling an email. And then, you know, maybe you schedule it this week, next week, next week. And then 2 weeks out. And then 4 weeks out. And then 6 weeks out. Just to continually check on those. So that's the list of things that, obviously it's not a step 1, 2, 3, but there's a list of recommendations. So we'll work off of that and then go from there. So thoughts on that, Bubba, Josh?
Well, the one we don't have is that there should be an after action debriefing. What happened? Let's take your statement. What happened? And it doesn't need to be the day after. It needs to be a while after. What happened? Where do we see issues? Did EMS come in the wrong gate? Was there a problem with because of construction? Whatever it is, or did it go flawlessly? Did it work as we had planned? Let's look at that. And then I think there needs to be a second one of these later if you ever get the cause of death, because that will determine a lot of of what happened and maybe what needs to change. Again, we're not pointing blame at anything or anybody, but to look at this and go, you know what? Maybe we need 2 more AEDs, or we need to move them where they are. No, they're right exactly where they need to be, and we don't need any more. We don't need to change anything. Everything was great. Or who knows? But I think you need to go in and look at it, just like they do with the military. We went on a mission, we come back and we debrief. Mm-hmm. this went wrong, this went right, and they learn from that. And we should learn from these. We should not only support those that were involved in this catastrophic event, but we should then learn from what happened to always strive to be better and more efficient and more effective.
Yeah, I think in every, you know, in any event, anybody that's not doing that, right, how can you, you executed the plan. The plan will never go flawlessly.
Right.
It never will. And so when you identify these areas of weakness, you're able to come back, develop a plan of action, and close these gaps. Mm-hmm. And I think they're, you know, as simple as you have emergency action plans that are rooted in you know, science, and they're posed on the, you know, NATA website, and you know, all these people have contributed to this, and that you follow this. Okay, now it's a matter of, all right, well, we implemented our emergency action plan, and where did we go wrong? I remember I was involved in a case where it was sudden cardiac arrest, and we need to go get the AED, and you know what we found? That battery, the AED, had died. And now you're kind of left in the middle of the ocean,
right?
You know, and there you are. And so what's your only option? You continue with compressions till EMS gets there.
Right.
And so now, you know, it's one of those things of there's chaos that ensues of, well, whose job was it to check the battery? Okay, well, we got to write that back into the EAP. And so, you know, in this case, hey, Bubba, every so often you need to go by and, you know, check the battery. And so, you know, it's one of those things of when you're putting together an after action plan, you know, it needs to be met with the same intense legal liability. You need to have professionals come to the table, and you need to have an agreement. My question to you guys is that, are there other school districts around Texas or around the country that have these after-action plans in place?
Part of our questions for later.
Well, you know,
so, yeah.
I guess I'm just jumping ahead. Today's my day to jump ahead of the cart today.
That's right.
I suppose so.
Bubba and I talked about this, and I downloaded it and typed it up in there, and I forgot to upload. So the other thing that I forgot was contact the family and request their side of the story to help prevent future occurrences. So,
and hang on, though. And I think you got to be careful with that one. And thinking about it, I think you contact the family. But I think the more I think about that one, you got to be careful, because you say, well, we want to know this to prevent this. Well, are we admitting guilt? So it's got to be worded very, very carefully how that's said. I think the family needs to be contacted by the district and say, is there anything we can do for you? But again, not to point blame. I'm not an attorney. I'm not someone that does this. My name's Bubba. Let's face it. Okay. But you've got to be careful in how you word that, because you may sit there and say, well, what we did was wrong. And now they're mad at you, when what you did may not have been wrong at all. It would be nice to know the cause of death, because that would help down the line. But I don't know how to go about doing that without, you know what I'm saying, to make sure we're not saying, well, we were wrong or we weren't wrong, or they think we're blaming them. Who knows? I think that's got to be very lightly tread upon to handle. But regardless, they need to be contacted and offered condolences and any assistance they need. They may have other kids in the school district. You know, what can we do for you?
I guess I disagree a little bit. I think that the cause of death is probably a little bit more important to me.
No, I'm saying it is important. I think you got to be careful in how you phrase wanting that information, so you can say, because in essence, what do we want the cause of death for? So we know what happened, so we can look at it. But you don't want to look at it and say, in how you say it, well, we think we might have screwed up, but we want to know so we don't screw up again. That's my point, is not admitting there was fault or wrong, finding the way to ask for it where you're not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's all in the way that it's presented.
Right.
You know, we want to be able to find the cause of death so that we can go back and improve
exactly
our responses.
Make sure that everything is being done appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, if this is a congenital abnormality, there's not a whole lot we can do about this.
Right.
Right?
Right. But at the same time, not saying, well, we want to make sure we don't screw up the next time. Well, you didn't screw up this time, but you just said you did. That's my point. Mm. How it's phrased, especially when it's still raw and early, mm-hmm. you know, I just look at that and go, I might take that differently a month after versus 3 months after. Mm-hmm. And so how it's presented, you know, makes a difference. But again, I'm not the person, hopefully, that's ever going to be making that phone call and having to ask that question.
Yeah.
All right. So I got one question from off of Twitter. Someone asked, what is there anything that's currently available to athletic trainers in this area that deal with this other than the district? So Bubba, Josh, do y'all know of anything, any sort of counseling other than, hey, you called me and said, yeah, hey, I've been through this, let me help you. Do you guys know of anything?
I don't know of any formal type, you know, I don't know of any formal groups like this. I know that in some areas, you know, obviously in an area like Houston, the city is enormous, right? And that, you know, you have certain cliques of athletic trainers and, you know, obviously, and that's normal that would happen in a size like Houston. In some of the smaller areas, the athletic training community is, you know, a little bit more intimate. But from a national level, I don't know anything that's out there. And I certainly can probably pose this question to Dr. Saylor, who's the president of the NATA, and ask, you know, is there anything in place as far as, you know, after action planning for athletic trainers? I've heard some discussions along the line that there needs to be more things in place to help clinicians. You know, my question is, in medicine, you know, if you are a resident or you're a fellow and you're in the emergency room, and, you know, a patient dies, what's the process that happens in medical school? What's the process that happens while you're in residency? What's the process that happens in that ER? Are there already things that we can look at and say, this is what happens here, and can we...
They do exist at the hospitals, I know.
Yeah, can we take that and morph that into, you know, our needs? Obviously, you know, so many people compare us to other like allied healthcare professions, but there's a certain intimacy to what we do and who we treat. And when something like this happens, right, you know, you are emotionally invested, and it's hard to divest from that because, you know, you're always going to go back and think, did I do everything I could have done?
Right.
Did I make a mistake? Did I say things to the family? You know, what did I do? And so, again, I would go back, and Bubba, you're associated with the hospital. I'd go back and look at those after-action plans. What's in place? And more importantly, what's in place for our younger clinicians, right? You have somebody that just came out of school. You have somebody that, you know, is really in clinical practice for a very short period of time, and something like this happens.
Right.
What's in place to help them?
Well, I think it goes back to at your district level, and I'm going to try to answer their question at the same time. At the district level, having the mandated counseling session to me is huge. But also, you've got the ability typically through your employer to get that help on your own outside of that. But maybe... Oh, it's a reminder. Maybe that also, why can't we start a support group online?
Right.
You know, and so for people that have been through this to help others, and people that just are curious, you know, not the morbidly curious, obviously, but curious to say, hey, you know, what should I expect? Because honestly, you hope you never have to know what to expect, because the only way to know what to expect is you've gone through it.
Right. And that's what happened when this happened. I think that day I reached out to Jeremy and I said, look, I've experienced this before. And, you know, I want to reach out to you and just tell you that, you know, I've been where you are.
Right.
And if I can help you, you know, let me know.
Right.
And so, you know, we exchanged a couple text messages, and I think Jeremy, I think I probably kept that up for maybe 2 weeks, just dropped a line. Hey man, how you doing? But you know, it stopped after that. Right. And so right. One of the questions that I have is, and you see this in grief, situations, right? That when the incident happens, there's an immediate gathering of the community, and then that community forms the support. And then over time, you know, people need to get back to their lives. And so what I've always said is that, you know, I'm not really worried about that first week. Sometimes I'm not even worried about that first 2 weeks, because I know that community is there. But the real work is going to start after that support goes away.
Right.
And that, you know, obviously the family needs to recover and the clinicians need to recover. And, you know, the district, if you're in a high school setting or a school setting, if you're in a college setting, if you're whatever setting you're in. Unfortunately, I would probably predict that this is going to be more of a common occurrence, not the high school kids dying like we're seeing all these different reports. But, you know, I made a statement maybe 10 years ago. We are going to see something, you know, with the way that sport is going, increase in hitting, all this other stuff, where this is not just going to be a common factor at the high schools, but this will be a common factor in colleges and pros. Mm. You know, the level of intensity that we're asking our athletes to engage in is just you know, astronomically increased. And so this needs to be in place not only for the high school athletic trainers, but, you know, the college and the pro. And what happens to those athletic trainers that are in the military?
Right.
Right? And they are training, or, you know, I work with some of the athletic trainers at NASA. You know, what one of the questions I had was, you know, when the last shuttle exploded, how did they handle that?
Right.
You know, what process do you go through? What's in place? Right. And so a lot of times, unfortunately, from a healthcare perspective, we put things in place for the patients and the families, but we don't give ourselves the attention that we need. And I think these are really important conversations.
Hey, Jeremy, this just, and I don't know why it hadn't come to me before now. Let me ask you this. All right. So you went through all this. What went through your mind, for lack of a better way to put it, the first time you're sitting in that training room and somebody runs in and says, we need you at X, and you have no clue what's going on? It's happened. I know it's happened since then. Somebody, you know, you don't know what's going on. We need you here.
Yeah, I think.
Do you hesitate for a second? I mean, are you like, here we go? Or, I mean, you know, because I think that's some of the point of this whole conversation.
Right. I don't think it really changed anything because, you know, this is my 12th year. And so for so long, people have come in, hey, somebody got hurt at softball. Hey, somebody got hurt in the gym. Okay, well, what's wrong? That's almost immediate. I say, all right, what happened? I don't know. They just got hurt.
Right.
Well, I don't know. They're down. They're just laying down on the track, or, you know, hey, they're face down or whatever.
Right.
Well, that may be different, but that's, I think I always automatically say, what's up? What's wrong?
Right.
What happened?
But what was your first through your head the first time you had to do that after, if you even remember?
I don't remember. Like I said, it was at the end of the year. So then we had all summer.
So that's probably good, because I think the point being, you didn't freeze or hesitate or
right.
That's my point. You know, Mentally you were ready to do this again if you had to.
Yeah, I think so. I don't feel like it's made me hesitate or always go grab the AED every time I go take care of an injury. Mm-hmm. So
right.
It's a good question.
You're not carrying around on a backpack with you all the time, no matter where you go. And yeah, I mean, so
some of the comments in the chat room, I didn't check on the name, but a couple of people were saying they do monthly AED checks. Like you were saying,
right,
your AED was dead, and we have a log where we're supposed to check. And I think we have six on campus, and the three that we're responsible for here in the athletic facilities, we check each month and just check and make sure the batteries are good, turn it on, turn it off, and then go from there.
Really, it ought to be weekly, make sure the light's flashing green or whatever, the checkbox or whatever your AED is. Then a monthly check where you turn it on would be even better.
Okay.
You know, walk by, all right, the check mark's there, we're good, it's not an X or whatever. And then if that's the, you know, the kind you have, then turn it on monthly and make sure that it's does its little, you know, mm-hmm, adult pads, whatever, and all right, it's working, we can turn it off.
All right. And then Katmar in the chat room said that she thinks they should debrief after every serious injury. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not quite sure, Kat, what you mean by every serious injury. Is that anytime somebody goes to the hospital, you know?
If I could speak for Kat, I would say catastrophic. You know, I don't know if we need to debrief for an ACL tear, but the times where I felt like I really needed to speak to somebody, there was one time where I was at the AAU Junior Olympics. This was in Louisiana, and we were at the Castine Center, and I mean, there was a catastrophic injury that occurred, and nobody, you know, I was the only athletic trainer that was there, and so I responded, you know, and it was one of those things where chaos just broke. And afterwards, once we had managed the case, you know, I needed a second, and so the facility manager came up to me and said, you know, do you need anything? And my response was, I mean, not to be funny, but I said, I need about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I walked out and I threw up. And I just, you know, that's how I responded to it. And then, you know, I remember one of the thoughts that I had in my head was, I still have a job to do.
Right.
Right. And so you got to go back and do that job. And so you don't have any time.
Suck it up, buttercup, it's time to go back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's one of those things of, I think it's about time that, from a sports medicine standpoint, you know, we tend to not include the emotional and psychological side, right? Like you just said, suck it up, buttercup, or throw some dirt on it, or, you know, whatever it is. But it's about time that we recognize that, you know, there are feelings associated with this,
right?
Especially in situations that athletic trainers are working. You know, you see your patients every day. You see them day in and day out, and you've made connections with them. And if you're in a situation where, you know, you get to see them, say, in the high school level from 9th to 12th grade, these are very important times.
Mm-hmm.
Or in college, you know, let's say 5. Or even the pros, you've been with the team for 10 years, or in, you know, in another setting like
right.
NASA. Okay, you live in, you know, you grow with these people.
Right.
And
right.
So it's one of those things of, hey, look, we need to be able to manage this.
Right. I look at it from when should we debrief? Obviously, loss of life. I think something catastrophic, i.e. paralysis, loss of limb, potential loss of limb type thing. Because if you do it every time you send somebody to the emergency room, may be sending them to the emergency room because they're having trouble breathing. And, you know, so we're not going to do it. We still may debrief off quickly what went right, what went wrong.
Sure.
Did they need to go? Well, mommy wanted them to go, so we sent them.
I think you should be doing that anyway, right? That's how you're closing the loop.
But it's a quick, you know, it's quick versus a long, drawn out.
Right.
You know, I think we always debrief, so it's, again, no right, wrong answer on some of this.
We
do it, but some of it is very, well, we shouldn't do that next time. This kid's a drama queen, or, you know, or, no, we good call sending them, you know, whatever it is, talk about it a little bit and let's go. For the bigger ones is a longer drawn out process.
Right. And I think that as we move, you know, there's always this big talk about athletic training being, you know, we need a seat at the table in the medical model.
Right.
Okay. So going back to the question I had, if we're looking at the physicians and the physicians that deal with these traumas, right? ER docs, et cetera. What's the process that they go through? And we need to be able to form that. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. Catastrophic injury, right? A paralysis, a fractured, you know, neck or spine, you know, death, a loss of limb. These are all things that are very traumatic. Not only traumatic to be a part of, but traumatic to see.
Right.
And so, you know, what's the process that's in place? And as far as going back to debrief, I think anybody in any situation, right? I don't care if it's a sprained ankle. I don't care if it's an evaluation of a concussion. I don't care what it is. If you're not going back and constantly closing that loop, that loop and evaluating of, you know, what could I have done better? Well, you know, that's somebody I just don't want to be around.
Right.
Whether it needs to be a formal process or not, being, you know, in a room talking, et cetera. Well, I think that's warranted on the intensity of the injury.
Right. Should we put this guy in an immobilizer or not? Should we put him in a boot or not? We do that, but we don't, but it's quick.
Right.
And again, we don't do it at the bigger level.
Right.
You know, which is why we're sitting here.
Right. So, I agree with all that.
What else you got, Jeremy?
Sorry, I was looking in the chat room just to...
Come on, multitask. Let's go.
I can't. They say when you do that, then you're not very efficient.
Oh, then I'm not very efficient every day.
No comment, but
Yeah, thank you. Anytime you want to trade places with me, let me know.
What day is it?
So, Josh, you have been part of CPR, both successful or with the person surviving and with them failing.
Yes.
Tell me some of the things that, in your specific situation, some of the things that you've felt really helped that we might not have hit already.
Helped in terms of me in processing? Dealing with,
yeah. So this is all about the after-action plan.
Uh-huh. So I'm going to speak very generically because I'm not going to use any names or situations to protect, you know, just in case anybody's listening. You know, one of the things that helped me was that I was able to speak to a couple of my mentors about...
into the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. One of the things that helped me was that I was able to speak to one of my mentors about, you know, this is what happened and this is what I did. And when I explained exactly the process that I went through, right? And so I'm a CPR instructor and AED through the American Heart Association. And I always tell people the worst thing that is going to happen, which is what we're talking about, death, is the easiest thing to treat, right? In terms of everything else you're going to learn is differential diagnosis and, you know, these special tests. But in a situation where there is a cardiac death, well, call 911, get the AED and start CPR. And so that's a pretty easy process to follow. One of the things that I guess gained comfort in is that when I was able to reflect back on how I responded to some of these situations, I did what I was trained to do. You know, now you bring up a bigger issue of, you know, is this, in my opinion, you know, is this person a religious person? Is this person a spiritual person? Is this person, you know, whatever it is. And I don't bring that up because, well, you know, you're going to have to make peace with God or who, you know, whatever term you want to use for that. My point in saying that was I did what I was trained to do. And then the rest is not my decision to make.
Right.
Right. That's not.
We do our part. We hand them off to EMS. We're done.
Well,
in essence, you did your part.
Yeah, but I would debate. I'd actually disagree with the "we're done" part.
We're not done, but our part in that process for that point in time is
right. Done. Right, you acted as a first responder, and so one of the conversations that I had with our MAT students is that part of our anatomy class is that we have a cadaver anatomy class, right? And so I'm always very keen about observing their responses when they the first time they see a cadaver. And this was taught to me when I was in cadaveric dissection with one of my professors, and then I went on to be a dissection team in graduate school. And that you're looking at this cadaver, right? This is a this was a living right organism, but it's still a human being. And so you have, if it's a male cadaver, right? I have everything that the male cadaver has, or he has everything that I have,
right.
Except for one thing, right? I've got this life,
right?
Okay, and he doesn't. And so now it's you start to get into some of these higher level type thought processes of what happens when and what happens if. So to answer your question, I mean, we took a long way around to get there, Jeremy, but what helped me was I knew in how I responded, okay, I did everything I could. I responded the right way. You know, it just is not going to work out every time. And I don't know how you get around that. I still, the first time I performed CPR, it was, you know, I knew the person, so I was emotionally tied. And that person had, you know, been a staple in my life. And so it took me a while. And, you know, some of the questions that I had was, well, I'd gone through all this education, I'd gone through all this training, but I still couldn't, you know, it wasn't a successful outcome. But that goes back to, you know, that's not for me to decide. On top of it, I think it goes back to one of the things that Bubba talked about. What are some factors, and I think that's a natural occurrence, what are some factors that occurred leading up to this, right? So let's just say in a situation, let's take it out of athletics and put it into the normal population. Well, the person was out of shape. You know, the person had heart disease. The person was diabetic. You know, you can make all of these other types of, you know, rational or irrational thought processes or conclusions. But the fact of the matter is that you were still put in the situation and that you had to perform. And that whether you perform well or not doesn't always predict the outcome, right? And so when I have conversations with people, okay, well, geez, we've seen cases where, you know, a kid wears a knee brace and still literally gets his knee blown out. We've seen cases where, you know, we've rehabbed areas that are, you know, they're 125%, 150% of the unaffected limb, and we still experience injury. You know, just because you wear your seatbelt and you have an airbag doesn't mean that you're not going to die. We're trying to limit the occurrences. We're trying to limit, you know, these catastrophic outcomes. But fact of the matter is that bad things are still going to happen.
Right. And you talked about earlier, you know, I'm a CPR instructor, and I always tell them, I don't care what you do, do something. I don't care if it's 37 compressions and 6 breaths, or you're doing 30 and 2, do something over nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a coach says, you know, if you're going to screw up going 100%. You know, it's kind of the same thing. Do it as best you can, but do something.
Yeah, you know, and the other thing too is that it's really hard, unless you're really put in a situation like that, it's hard to predict of how somebody's going to respond, right? And so you can rehearse and you can rehearse and you can rehearse, and we can come up with all these different simulations. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember in Los Angeles, you know, geez, we would rehearse earthquake drills all the time. Well, you know, I was there for the Northridge earthquake. I was on that epicenter. And when that thing hit at 4:31 in the morning, it was like, okay, well, you know, let me get my bearings and let me figure this out. And so a lot of times people feel like, you know, and I always give these analogies, right? So, you know, you're water skiing, and if you know anything about water skiing and you fall, what do they tell you to do? Let go of the rope.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of those things of, okay, you just got hit with this huge wave, and what are you supposed to do? Oh yeah, I'm supposed to let go of the rope, right? But you don't always remember this. And so you have to always rehearse this in your mind. How is this going to go? The other thing I would tell you is this, Jeremy, you know, you've experienced this once. I don't know what the statistics are of you experiencing it again. I think it's just as, you know, I've gone through it more than one time. And so I'm not going to tell you that each time it gets easier. I'm going to tell you that each time you're more capable of handling the after, right? That, okay, I've been through this experience before, and, you know, whether the outcome was positive or negative, I knew that I responded the way I was supposed to respond.
All right, I'm going to go through some of this stuff in the chat room. Alexandra Blinna says student counseling services should also be available to staff. Let me see. There we go. Should also be available to a class for all medical professionals that should discuss how to help themselves seek help in the event of catastrophic events. So on that note there, Josh, as you're preparing the next generation of athletic trainers, is this something you did. You might have mentioned this, but I know you said you did rounds in the ER, mm-hmm. and I know your kids do a lot of different clinical rounds. Is dealing with this something that they're learning? Because I never did.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things of, and unfortunately, in any medical field, a student is going to learn when somebody's hurt, right? Yeah, we can create all these different simulations. And so I'm always very keenly aware of, you know, how are they responding? You know, how did they respond to X situation? How did they respond to Y situation? I think luckily so far in this program, at least, you know, I haven't had any students go through a catastrophic event. At my previous institution, I think we had a couple times where, you know, because he's just there for, I think I was there for about 10 years. And so statistically speaking, yeah, you're just going to, you know, you have to play the cards and it's going to happen. And so, yeah, we try to create scenarios where, you know, how do you respond to this? And I think certain things are put in place. You know, one of the things is, quite honestly, the cadaver, right? How is somebody going to respond to working with a cadaver? How is somebody going to respond in a tense situation? Whether that be in the face of, you know, your supervising athletic trainer, or, you know, a tense situation in a game, or, you know, all these are predictive factors. It's very difficult for them to really think about this until you've experienced it. And next semester is when our first cohort will go through the, you know, the psychological interventions class. And so there are all these different things. You know, I know Dr. Ray Castle at LSU, one of the things that he puts his students through as they're applying, I think, is a psychological readiness test. And I, you know, I thought, well, that's something that we should probably add. You know, I asked my students to go through a number of different things that I think are there just to help them. Right? They're, it's a resource to them. And we need to be able to prepare them to experience this, right? Because you don't really know the first time, you know, even if it's a sprained ankle, you don't know how you're going to respond. You know, when you're the person,
yelling at you.
Yeah, you know, when you're the person, how are you going to respond to that? And you've got to go through some training. And, you know, luckily we've got some, you know, clinical assignments in place that allow them to kind of grow into this. And they're being mentored by people that have been doing this for a while.
We can't control the human factor.
Right.
You know, and it's a huge part of it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I've been in situations where, you know, parents have yelled and screamed, and coaches have yelled and screamed. And I can think back. And the other thing I do, Jeremy, too, is that I think it's really important for this younger generation that's coming up that, you know, their faculty and their staff and their preceptors be very honest with them. I'm very honest with them. I can tell you all the times that I've screwed up and that I've learned from this. You know, the first time that I experienced a fracture on the field, oh my God, I want to go back and write an apology note to everybody that I interacted with in those 10 minutes because, you know, I must have looked like an absolute buffoon. The first time that, you know, I got into it with a coach, you know, but, you know, you're a young clinician and, you know, you have to learn these things. And so...
Right. No, it does come from experience. I know what I would have blown a gasket over 20 years ago, I go, I'm not even worried about that.
Yeah, anymore. That's right.
You know, but that comes with age, experience, and we hope some wisdom,
yeah.
You know, over time. But, you know, because I know my former student trainer became a coworker, and she's like, you used to gripe about this. I don't...
It doesn't matter anymore. Right.
I've got bigger issues to deal with.
Right.
Now, you know, and now 6 months from now, that may become an issue again. But right now, I'm over that.
Yeah.
And right. That comes from dealing with those situations.
All right, so Josh, in the time where you've done CPR and the person survived, mm-hmm. was there any sort of counseling done after that?
Because
Keith said he had a situation similar. The athlete survived. He was performing life-saving skills, and it was successful.
Uh-huh.
Was there any sort of follow-up after that?
No.
Do you think there should be?
Yes.
Because one of the things Kat Marsh said...
I think any time that you're involved in a catastrophic event, okay, and when I talk about catastrophic, let's define it the way it should be defined. You're talking about death or a major spinal cord injury, or you're talking about, in certain situations, you know, loss of limb. You know, these are catastrophic events. Running out on the field and performing Lachmans is not maybe catastrophic to the person that just tore their ACL and their season's over. But for you, no, these are the catastrophic events. And so, no, there was never really a debrief or anything in place, but I think there should be. Anytime something like this happens, there needs to be a time where we can just calm down. And so, you know, this happened to me when I was an undergraduate. I didn't realize it was happening, right? And luckily, I had somebody in place that had been doing this for a while, and it was one of those nights where just the earth opened up and swallowed everybody whole. And we were covering both at that time, you know, it was the B team, you know, and then the varsity game. And so the B team played in the afternoon, the varsity played at night. And these events happened in between the two. And the supervisor at the time, you know, the head official came out and said, look, we got to start the game. In order for us to do this, you know, the athletic trainers need to be on the field. And he just very calmly said, we're not coming out until we're ready to come out. And I didn't know how to process that at the time. But I know how to,
if that happened today, you would handle it totally right. different.
Yeah, but I know how to process it now.
Right.
You know, and that process would be like, we need 10 minutes, right? Because we got to talk about what we just experienced. And are we okay to go out there again and perform our jobs? And so, yeah.
Which goes back to the counseling if you're involved in that.
Right.
Later.
You know, and it's one of those things. And so I think these are all experiences that you talk about. And you know, the other thing you need to realize too, Jeremy, is that we're a medical profession. And if I were to look around to all the other medical professions, if I compare us, you know, to the other like allied healthcare professions, if I compare us to medicine, all those other things, my question is, what's in place to help them? And in the medical profession, we're so dedicated to treating our patients, right? We're so, in today's time where it's about patient outcomes and evidence-based practice. Well, what about us? And so there needs to be some systems in place because, you know, now you're leading into bigger issues of burnout, emotional burnout, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder or symptoms or, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
I have to, I got to break out. I actually have to be somewhere else. Bubba, it's always a pleasure, sir.
Good seeing you.
Yeah. I noticed. Did you notice, Jeremy? I said it's always a pleasure, and he can't say the same.
Well, I was going to say something, but I realized we were on the air, so I was just saying. Same goes to you.
Okay.
Thank you, Alan. I always appreciate
don't
your
sense of humor. So
yeah,
your
that's
wisdom
right.
and input here. So
Jeremy,
thanks for,
everything you're doing. You know, I'm sorry that this occurred, but I think that the result of this will be much better, and that this young man will have not died in vain. That because of these conversations, you know, these situations will improve, and it won't just happen at a very small level. You know, this is a platform where the rest of the country can listen and learn and give some input. And hopefully this will go and create some position statements that can create some change. So I applaud you. Thank you.
Thank you. Right.
Take care.
We'll see you. Always good to see you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right.
You, but thank you. You should,
so,
but anyway.
So as we're kind of wrapping it up here, I'm just going to read through these recommendations again. And let me switch it off of Bubba so you don't see him picking his nose. All right, so I just set this camera up. Let's see. It looks a little weird. It's right up on me. Some of the recommendations we would like to include in the catastrophic death action after action plan is that the district administrative personnel should be on the scene immediately to debrief the professionals involved with providing the care, to get the statements, to offer counseling or an ear. The district should require each person involved to attend mandatory counseling session by a licensed counselor at least one session. The district should allow the involved individual to take some time off immediately following, and then allow for time in the near future where those days don't count against the pay or the vacation time of that person as they deal with and work through the emotions and the grief. The district sets gradually increasing intervals to make contact with the individual involved rescuers and just check in. Again, that can be scheduled text or schedule email. Again, just regular interval contact. There needs to be an after-action debriefing. So anytime you activate the EAP, the Emergency Action Plan, Alexandra Blennis said this at Boston University, every time that the EAP is activated, they do a debriefing so that you can get better. And we want to contact the family and just hear their side of the story and see if maybe there's something that we can take from their side of the story that will improve the way we react or respond next time. And Bubba mentioned caution when asking for the cause of death so that it's not saying, hey, we didn't do this good enough last time. Or it's just, we want to hear your story. We want to know how you perceive it and then see if there's something that we can improve on in the event of something happening again. We want to institute weekly AED checks where you just walk by and check and see that the green light is there, and then a monthly AED check where you actually turn it on to be sure the batteries are good We want to debrief after every serious injury. So again, catastrophic injury is just as Dr. Yellen just defined, or I would say anytime the EAP is involved, you want to debrief. I like that. And then you want to connect with a mentor. Like I said, that was huge, and just hearing from so many people. My wife answered my phone for 2 days with texts and emails and phone calls because I didn't really want to talk to anybody. And if I did, then I was going to contact them. And or like Josh called, and I accepted his call because, certain reasons, you know. And so connecting with a mentor, or making way for you to connect with a mentor. So that is our proposed recommendations for the catastrophic after action plan. Bub, anything I left out?
Not that I can think of.
Not that you can think of?
No. Are we gonna ask for their input?
Yeah, and so I am going to email those people that are on the email list. And the people, so hopefully if you're logged in live, you're on the email list. If not, then it's pretty easy. Go to that website. It's right there on the right-hand side. And then I'm going to send this out and just say what other suggestions you have, what other comments you have. And then we're going to take those. I'm going to kind of filter through them. And then if we need to, we can kind of vote or rearrange them a second time. And then obviously the idea is for you there to be a piece of paper that you can print out and say, hey, district superintendent, this is what I would like to implement in our school district, so that the process afterwards, the grief, the healing is easier for you. And hopefully you can learn from our experiences. Any other thoughts, comments there?
No, that does it.
Okay. Sportshealth.com. As I was sitting earlier, you could see the cool banner they got behind me. I talked to Greg Evans last week, and they're sending out some stuff to me to test out, to share with you. And so if there's something that you'd really like to hear about or see about, let me know, and then I can request it from Greg, test it out, and then give you my input and feedback. You can also enter to win a gift card from School Health each month because you're a listener to the Sports Medicine broadcast. So go to schoolhealth.com. sportshealth.com/SMB. The December code is FOOBAG. So FOOBAG is the December code, which just recently would have been very good to have because it was really rainy for the weekend for some of the games. And I saw lots of pictures on Twitter of people having to throw out tape and all this other stuff because it got wet. So check them out. FOOBAG is the December code for sportshealth.com/SMB. You can check out our website, again, if you want to sign up for the email list there, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, where you can watch live almost every single Wednesday on the website. You can join the conversation by joining in here, as we got Doc Hill, Christy Keeler, John Prosek, Greg Gorig, Alexandra Blinnis, Catherine Marr, Keith Sherman, Catherine Windsor. And so thanks for joining live, for throwing in your comments there, for helping us just make this better. Thank you. And then for Jeremy, the Sports Medicine One, kids, Josh that left, and Bubba, that's a wrap.